Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Now, the month of September marks 25 years since Anwar Ibrahim was sacked as Deputy Prime Minister in 1998, soon after which he initiated the Reformasi movement. Now, tonight, 25 years later, Anwar is speaking in front of world leaders at the 78th UN General Assembly as the 10th Prime Minister of Malaysia. So on the show, I'll be speaking to analysts to dissect his speech, to analyse Malaysia's international standing and to discuss how we should position ourselves in an ever-changing world. Joining me in the studio is Herizal, international relations analyst Herizal Hazri. Thank you so much, Herizal, for continuing this discussion with me on Consider This. We just heard Anwar Ibrahim's speech, and I wanted to ask you, in terms of the things that stood out to you, when you think of what makes a good speech at this level, on this international stage, did Anwar Ibrahim's speech hit the mark?
Yes. Mm. You know, to be fair, I think when you hear a speech, obviously you look at the person who's delivering the speech. And, you know, that visual sort of like contact is important. I think Anwar Ibrahim sent a very good sort of like body language. Mm. I think he was consistent. He was assertive. I think that's very important at the United Nations. I think he basically delivered the urgency that the world and the international community needed to hear. I think so that was all good. In terms of the content, I see that it's consistent to Malaysia's position in the past, which is excellent. I think as a country, we need to continue to drive our agenda at the United Nations. And this agenda cannot change for, you know, it can be sort of like adjusted. But I think Malaysia must be firm with our stand, and that I saw, you know, from his speech.
So when you talk about continuity, this consistency in every UN General Assembly speech from Malaysia's leaders, what are the points that you're looking for to establish that continuity?
Well, you know, there are things that Malaysia has always been a champion, number one, and number two, that we are very concerned about. Right. So a champion, Malaysia has always been a champion of, you know, smaller nations, mm-hmm. Developing countries at the world stage. We have always been championing, you know, the cause of the oppressed, you know, all over the world. We have always been very consistent about, you know, our stand in terms of, you know, major powers' role, in terms of war, where essentially, you know, we are very firm that no country should invade another sovereign country. So those are the key points that I always look out for. And I'm very glad that it came out tonight. I think our stand on the war in Ukraine is clearer. I think the Prime Minister has said it, that, you know, Malaysia essentially has a very clear stand, you know, on the war in Ukraine. And I think on Afghanistan is also quite interesting because not only we just talk about Afghanistan as a country that is war-torn, a country that is facing a lot of problems, but we also state our firm commitment to engage the government of Afghanistan that, you know, the oppressed sort of like, you know, policy or oppressive policy against women, you know, to be educated is something that we do not support. And I think we did an interview on Afghanistan maybe a couple of years ago, and there was questions of whether if Malaysia should engage Afghanistan or not. And I remember vividly in that interview I mentioned that Malaysia as a country should continue to engage Afghanistan, just like how we engage Myanmar. It doesn't mean that we agree with everything that the government or the, you know, whether if it's accepted or not, the so-called government or leadership in Afghanistan is, or the so-called government or leadership in Myanmar is. But as a country, we have to play a role to continue to engage them and to assert, you know, things that we feel is important, because isolating any countries is not a good idea.
Okay. So he covered quite a lot of ground in that 15. I mean, they only get 15 minutes anyway before the red light comes on, right? So he covered quite a lot of ground: climate change, SDGs, Palestine, Afghanistan, Myanmar, Islamophobia. Was there anything that he missed?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot,
But what would you have liked to have heard him say?
You know, essentially because I mentioned about how Malaysia should be consistent, and I think Malaysia has always been a nation that calls for reform at the United Nations, right? We never drop that. You know, we continue to say that the United Nations need to change. It needs to realign itself with the current, you know, trend of the world. You know, as a platform that we feel still, you know, carries most of the, you know, country's voices, it needs to really figure out what's next. You know, having the normal, like, you know, our Prime Minister mentioned that, you know, the stage was initiated, you know, 80 years ago. But today, is today this stage enough to me, right?
Yes.
So that kind of reforms at the United Nations, I think, is important. One country, one vote, for instance, is important. The reform of the Security Council at the United Nations is actually, you know, very important. The question of veto power at the United Nations is very important. We have always brought this agenda, and we are one of the countries that has always been consistent. We say it year in, year out. We put our commitment to the United Nations, but that's not unconditional. We continue to say that we are always a committed member of the United Nations.
Right.
However, this body needs to reform.
I have to ask you, though, Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim also alluded to this. This is an era that is marked by skepticism, by skepticism about institutional, international institutions, about multilateralism. Does the UN, as a global platform, does it still hold significance, this UN General Assembly, as a place to discuss global issues, as a place for world leaders to really come together? Is it still that platform that we turn to?
Well, that's the problem, right? We can't help to be a skeptic because, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, UNGA 78, you have only one of the five founding members present. And the fact that Washington, D.C. is probably like a couple of hours away from New York, probably, you know, Biden can't say no to it. But the fact that all of these other countries are not present, and other countries that are important as well, such as India, also not present, and we can't help to be a skeptic. We can't help to question whether if this is truly a platform that brings together, you know, all these powers. But what's really interesting is that the developing countries continue to be present. The developing countries continue to put all their effort, you know, their energy to voice their concerns, you know, at the United Nations. So on one hand, we can be skeptical to say that maybe the United Nations is no longer that choice of forum of bigger powers, but we can say that maybe the smaller powers or the middle powers at the United Nations are taking over, which is a great thing. You know, but also we have to understand today there are many other platforms, and we see that BRICS is expanding. We see that, you know, other governments are putting effort. You know, I one thing that I think is also interesting is Indonesia's presence, right? We know that, you know, this is a very busy year for Jokowi, right? This is his final year.
Yes.
You know, there's, you know, all these other platforms that he's hosting, and there's the United Nations General Assembly. What's interesting is that Jokowi is not at the United Nations General Assembly. So if you talk about ASEAN, this is the largest country in ASEAN. Are we seeing that the largest member of ASEAN not really interested in the United Nations? I'm not saying it's good or bad. Maybe it's good. Maybe that Indonesia can put more interest on other platforms. Maybe Indonesia can build ASEAN to be a stronger platform. I don't know. But Indonesia is also not in BRICS, right?
Mm.
So to me, these are all interesting dynamics that we are not entirely sure where these countries are heading. You know, people are writing about it. We are, you know, pundits are making assumptions and stuff like that. But what I think is important here is, I go back, you know, to the question of whether if the United Nations wants to continue to be relevant. And of course, to Guterres, he wants the United Nations to be relevant. And questions have been posed to him. Is this still relevant? And he said, well, you know, we are actually having some problems, but it is not yet point of no return. Like, you know, we can reverse this.
It's
United
salvageable.
Nations, yeah, you know. So I think, you know, for people at the UN, they have been doing a lot of good work. I think they are working very hard. But I think there are fundamental sort of like issues where the United Nations have to be at pace of, you know, the changing sort of like dynamics of the world, looking at how other platforms are getting more attention, looking at important sort of like, you know, regional organizations like ASEAN, and not just, you know, as a multilateral, but having dynamic sort of like relationship with the blocs as well. The United Nations and ASEAN, right. What is that dynamic relationship that we have not seen yet?
Okay,
happening.
So we're going to come back to you, Ariza, in a little bit and get more of your thoughts on the speech. But right now, we're going to cross to the United Nations headquarters in New York, where Howard Lee joins us. He's an MP for Ipoh Timur, member of the Consultative Council for Foreign Policy. He's part of the Malaysian delegation there with the Prime Minister. Howard, you're on the line. Hello. Good morning.
I'm good.
Hi.
How are you?
Howard, good, thank you. So we've just heard the Prime Minister's speech. Can I ask you how you would describe what the primary objectives of the Prime Minister was in trying, with that speech? What was he trying to achieve by delivering that particular speech to that particular audience?
I think, thank you for inviting me. I think what we saw and what we heard from the Prime Minister just now, who's literally on my right, they're doing photo ops at the moment. What it sounded like and what it really did come across as was that it was a fiercely independent and powerfully, powerfully delivered critique of what is happening in the United Nations right now, where essentially we see people who shouldn't be there, weren't there, and essentially it's the rise of minilateralism. It's a critic, a strong critic against multilateralism, minilateralism that is happening right now, and it's a strong call for a return to real multilateralism. I think that's one of the key points at the start of the speech. And really, in the middle of the speech, where it was a projection of Malaysia's leadership and the current government, Malaysia Madani's, the unity government's leadership in the region, and also a strong projection of Malaysia as a global middle power.
I think that message was what was sent in the speech.
Okay, so I want to ask you, since you've been there, when you speak to the delegates who are at the General Assembly, how do they view Malaysia's international standing? What is Malaysia's brand, so to speak?
I think Malaysia's brand has just suddenly been reinvigorated, certainly with Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim as the Prime Minister. And we keep hearing Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim has been seen and heard as the Prime Minister in waiting for the last 20-something years. And finally, he's now the Prime Minister and here addressing the United Nations. There's huge excitement. You know, there was great anticipation in what he had to say, and now he said it. Definitely, it's met lots of expectation and exceeded expectation, especially in the way he and Malaysia, the Malaysian delegation, has projected leadership.
Okay. So, Howard, so we all heard the speech that he gave, but what I'm curious to know is what he's saying to all the Fortune 500 companies that he's been meeting with. What is he telling them about Malaysia, about his administration and his leadership to boost investor confidence? I want to know what he's promising them.
I think, number one, it's a strong message of clarity in policy. A strong message that Malaysia is open for business, and strongly so. And it's also a case of the clarity of policy of the current government, that maybe there was a bit of a slow start because we had to deal with a lot of institutional inertia issues upon taking over of the government. But essentially, Malaysia is open for business. There's clarity of vision, strong emphasis on NETR, the National Energy Transition Roadmap. And in that, there was lots of excitement in terms of feedback that came from the Fortune 500 companies. So Malaysia's open for business. We have clarity of policy, and we are not just waiting, but working hard in attracting investors to come and realize their investments in Malaysia.
Howard, thank you so much for speaking with me. We're going to take a very quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more on the Prime Minister's maiden speech at the 78th UN General Assembly. Stay tuned. welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Herizal Hezri in the studio with me, international relations analyst, and we're going to be discussing the Prime Minister who took center stage at the 78th General Assembly, 78th session of the UN, United Nations General Assembly, and that was his maiden address as the 10th Prime Minister of Malaysia. Joining me on the line is Elina Noor. She's a senior fellow with the Asia Programme at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Elina, thank you for joining me on the show today. I'm hoping you can help us cut through the diplomatic language of that speech and share what you think the Prime Minister's speech was really about. Just in plain terms, what do you think it was that he was trying to get across?
Well, thanks for having me on again, Melissa. It's good to see you. So, you know, I think, honestly, the Prime Minister was pretty frank in his remarks. He had some very forceful words to say about many of the crises the world is facing today. And you probably covered those with Herizal earlier. And I don't think he was very circumspect about how he felt about Afghanistan or about Palestine or about the future of multilateralism. So in essence, I would sum up his speech as, you know, we need to do more and do it better and effectively. And he stuck to the assignment, right? As the youngsters on social media these days say, he understood the assignment, he followed the theme of the UN GA 78th session and spoke about SDGs, about trust and global solidarity.
Was there anything that you found particularly noteworthy, Elina?
I really appreciated his themes of standing up for women and girls when he spoke about Afghanistan in particular. I thought that was a little unexpected, at least on my part. But I also really appreciated his calls for justice and equity when it comes to reforming and resolving some of the problems that we face today. And I think that was part of his Malaysia Madani message, but it was really important to underscore those traits, particularly when talking about the climate crisis, for instance.
How do you interpret what he was trying to say about that binary choice? When he talked about for the reality for many smaller countries is that there seems to be a binary choice between major powers. How are you understanding that, particularly in the context of the kind of the new global, the world order currently?
Yeah, you know, and again, he was being very candid and frank about that, because we hear a lot of this, oh, don't make us choose, we're having to choose, particularly by leaders and policy thinkers in Southeast Asia, having to choose between the United States and China. And the reality is, despite what both powers say, they are making us choose, and they're making us choose in very different ways, whether it's, you know, small decisions in terms of business and investment, or whether it's in larger decisions that are systemic and structural, such as what type of 5G infrastructure to install in our countries. These are choices that are being made every day that add up to larger strategic choices. And so I think him, the Prime Minister, having said it out early on in his speech, made it very clear that we're not going to be put into this position, but we're going to try to navigate it, which is what I think the purpose of him being in the United States right now is all about, meeting with investors and trying to carve out that strategic space for Malaysia.
Where do you think Malaysia should position ourselves? I'm curious to know, you know, going forward under the leadership of Anwar Ibrahim's 10th Prime Minister, how do you think Malaysia should position ourselves in an international setting?
I think it's not enough for us to just proceed on a one-to-one basis in terms of, okay, for the South China Sea issue, we're going to take a particular stand. On investment, we're going to take a particular stand. On trade, we're going to take a particular stand. It's not enough to do that. It's necessary, but insufficient. And I think we should be a lot more proactive in our decisions and in our policies, and more visionary. And so what I'm thinking of in my head is when we talk about renewable energy or when we talk about technology, for example, we need to be thinking about being at the table, making the rules, helping set the standards and the governance frameworks, because these issues will affect us at the end of the day. Right now, we are being treated as derivatives of the global order, and we are seen as users and consumers. In fact, we market ourselves that way. You know, come invest in us because we have a market of this, and we can do this, and we can do that. That's not enough. We have to be at the table. We have to help make those decisions that shape the game. It's not enough for us to be mere players.
Elena, thank you so much for your insights. Elena Ngo, Senior Fellow with the Asia Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Let's come now to Harizal. Harizal Hezri in the studio with me. Harizal, can I come back to something that Elena alluded to, something you talked about earlier, the fact that the middle power is growing. So the superpowers are you know, perhaps shying away from the UN stage. But when we talk about the middle powers, and I'm reminded by something Professor Denikwa from the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy said, that he said, beyond the US and China, the US and China, I think 80% of humanity is left. So we are 80% of humanity outside of the US and China. And we are a force to be reckoned with. We have agency and we have strength. So when you think about that and the agency that middle power countries have, how do we move forward outside of the, you know, the shifting superpowers of the world?
Well, I think there are two parts to the two parts answer to your question. Number one is obviously the global sort of like, you know, power rivalry, and how these middle powers are actually positioning themselves. Now, unfortunately, from my lenses, is that most countries in the world are very selfish. Right, countries are—they are there to basically achieve certain goals, and that's normal. Mm. You know, we expect that, and they are doing a great dance in terms of this power rivalry for whatever they that they can achieve out of it, whatever that they can benefit, they can win, they'll take it. And Malaysia is—you know—we play that game as well. You know, whenever that we feel it's good, convenient, profitable for us to engage with one superpower, will do that. And if we feel that we need to criticize the other superpower, we do that as well. That's the practicality part of international relations. And that happens. You can't change that. The second part is the more important part, I think, which is essentially whether if the middle power actually wants to play a bigger role. Oh. Now, we keep on saying this. We keep on saying that middle powers can bring themselves together, they can change the world, they know that, you know, if whatever happens, they'll be the most affected, blah, 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 so on and so forth. But there's a great challenge in bringing the middle powers together as well, because if they're busy dancing, profiteering from, you know, the big power rivalries, they're probably not organized enough to take that leadership. So I think the second question is the question that we need to address, right? And I do think that Malaysia is placed well to try and galvanize, you know, the middle powers so that we have some strategic direction. We can have a say. We can form coalitions, so on and so forth. I remember when I was, busy proposing and writing and getting it approved of what I call the International Coalition for Food Security. And we got it approved. We actually got countries to sign so that we can be part of middle power countries where we can address the food security ourselves. Because the fact of the matter is that most of this food production is actually within the middle powers, right? But we have to import grains, we have to import fertilizers. We don't have the latest technology for agriculture, for instance, to sustain. And at times, we are too busy exporting because we want to make money. So there are changes that we can make within a coalition, a group, that could actually address the issue of food shortage. Right. Now, that was approved, but obviously, I don't see it being implemented or it being done in a right. good way. But that we can see some
example of how you can use the middle power
exactly.
leverage. Harizal, thank you for sharing your insights with us, spending your evening, your Friday evening with
sure,
us.
No
appreciate
problems.
Your time. That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.